Introduction. As an EMT, you are a critical member of the emergency healthcare team that includes not only first responders, paramedics, and other EMTs, but also physicians, nurses, and other personnel who will help care for your patient throughout the duration of his or her injury or illness. You play a pivotal role bringing emergency medicine into patients' homes, assisting with advanced patient care skills, and ensuring the effective transfer of patient care to emergency department or ED staff when you arrive at the hospital. As an EMT, you will need to do more than acquire clinical knowledge and master necessary skills. You must also learn to be an effective team member. Essentially, this means communicating and collaborating with others who may have different backgrounds and levels of expertise than you have. By working as a team, emergency healthcare providers, from the first responders in the field to the physicians in the hospital, can improve patient and provider safety and deliver better emergency care. For basic life support, or BLS, and advanced life support, or ALS, providers to perform well together, each team member must share a common goal and demonstrate excellent communication skills. This chapter will provide an overview of the team healthcare approach and discuss how diversity among providers' backgrounds, skills, and abilities can strengthen a team. The chapter will also discuss how to assist with advanced skills and manage interpersonal conflict. The positive impact of effective teamwork on the delivery of healthcare is highlighted by such programs as the World Health Organization's Being a Team Player and in the American Heart Association's Chain of Survival. An era of team healthcare. Today, it is understood that for delivery of EMS to be effective, healthcare providers must work together toward a unified goal of patient care excellence. Historically, however, this was not always the case. Previous models of emergency care often consisted of providers who worked separately, passing the patient from one individual or group to the next. Gradually, emergency healthcare providers recognized that by working as a unified team from first patient contact to patient discharge, it was possible to improve individual and team performance, patient and provider safety, and, ultimately, patient outcome. This concept is known as the continuum of care. Community paramedicine and mobile integrated healthcare teams. Community paramedicine and mobile integrated healthcare, or MIH teams, may be the best example of the team concept of continuum of care. Recall from Chapter 1, EMS Systems, that in the MIH model, healthcare is provided within the community rather than at a physician's office or hospital. The success of MIH programs have shown that EMS providers, working as a unified team with in-hospital or other community healthcare providers, can improve patient outcomes, increase patient satisfaction, and reduce healthcare costs. Differences among teams. The structure and effectiveness of emergency healthcare teams differs from system to system. EMS providers may be trained as emergency medical responders, or EMRs, or may be BLS or ALS certified. They may be volunteers or full-time employees, and they may be based in police or fire departments, hospitals, or private agency settings. Multiple EMS agencies across different regions or response districts may respond to the same 911 call. Because of the variety of providers, agencies, and systems involved in each call, it may be difficult for all of the providers to function as one unified team. For instance, you may find it challenging to share patient assessment information and integrate newly arriving providers into ongoing care. As the chapter will discuss, such challenges can be overcome by ensuring effective communication and mutual respect. In this case, as new responders arrive, it is helpful to think of them as joining the team as opposed to taking over. Types of teams. Depending on the EMS system in which you work, you may consistently interact with the same team members. Other systems may require emergency healthcare providers to assemble their teams on the fly for each individual call. Regular teams. Some EMS systems rely on regular teams. In this model, EMTs consistently interact with the same partner or team and often become familiar with the other emergency healthcare providers and hospital staff with whom they frequently interact. Regular teams often train together. Team members who frequently train and work together are more likely to move smoothly from one step in the procedure to the next, performing as one seamless unit. By contrast, team members who train and work together less often may need more explicit verbal direction to accomplish their tasks, potentially leading to patient care delays. Temporary teams. Temporary teams are common in volunteer EMS systems. In this model, EMTs work with providers with whom they do not regularly interact or may not even know. This creates a special challenge. For a temporary team to function effectively, providers must work within an environment that supports and promotes collaboration rather than competition. It is crucial to have a clear understanding of the roles, responsibilities, and capabilities of each team member. One of the best ways to accomplish this is to train together when possible. Special teams. Some EMS systems form special teams whose members have particular knowledge, skills, abilities, equipment, and/or training to serve a specialized role within the larger emergency healthcare team. Examples include fire team, rescue team, hazardous materials or hazmat team, tactical EMS team, special event EMS team, EMS bike team, in-hospital patient care technicians, MIH technicians. Groups versus teams. Do not assume any gathering of EMS providers responding together on a call is a team. True emergency response teams have better interaction, performance, and patient outcomes than groups of healthcare providers who do not share a team dynamic. Groups. The National Incident Management System, or NIMS, defines a group as the organizational level that divides the incident according to functional levels of operation. Groups perform special functions, often across geographic boundaries. When operating under NIMS, EMS providers may often work as a group in this sense. In the context of this chapter, the term group is used in the more general sense. You must be able to distinguish between a group of providers gathered together on an emergency call and a true team. In the context of EMS, a group consists of individual healthcare providers working independently to help the patient. Some examples of EMS groups are triage, treatment, and transport groups at a mass casualty incident. In contrast, a team consists of a group of healthcare providers who are assigned specific roles and are working interdependently in a coordinated manner under a designated leader. In 1945, the Research Center for Group Dynamics first defined the five essential elements of a group that people must share. These elements include a common goal, an image of themselves as a group, a sense of continuity of the group, that is, an understanding that the group may work together more than once, even in a slightly different configuration, a set of shared values, that is, how the group wants to get things done, different roles within the group. These roles are often self-assigned. Once a group is formed, the ability to function as a true emergency response team depends on the way in which its members work together. Dependent, independent, and interdependent groups. Dependent. In dependent groups, each individual is told what to do, and often how to do it, by his or her supervisor or group leader. Group members rely on the group leader for task assignments, troubleshooting, and virtually all decisions, thus limiting the group's ability to adapt and deliver critical medical care in an uncontrolled field environment. Independent. In independent groups, each individual is responsible for his or her own area, either a physical space or set of tasks. Members of an independent group may receive support and guidance from a supervisor or group leader, but do not have to wait for an assignment before taking action as they would in a dependent group. Although independent group members may work on the same patient, each person is focused on individual goals, such as starting an intravenous or IV line, splinting an arm, etc., rather than on working together to achieve a unified goal. The classic example of a poor outcome of independent group work is the perfectly splinted and packaged trauma patient who was dead on arrival at the ED from a poorly managed airway that no one had noticed. Interdependent. EMTs and other healthcare providers who work interdependently are functioning as a true team. While each provider may still be assigned to a particular area or task, everyone in an interdependent group works together with shared responsibilities, accountability, and a common goal, that is, the best possible patient outcome, as opposed to focusing on the goals of their own individual areas. Effective team performance. Building on the five essential elements of a group, you will learn the five essential elements that healthcare providers must share to perform as an effective team. A shared goal. Every healthcare provider on the team, from EMT to paramedic to emergency physician, must be committed to a common goal, typically the best possible patient outcome. While this may seem like common sense, evidence of providers not working as a team can be heard in such alarming phrases as, "Why take the time to splint the patient if they're only going to undo it in the ED?" and "There is no point in doing good CPR if the paramedic wasn't even trying to save the patient." Clear roles and responsibilities. To achieve a common goal, each provider must know what needs to be done and what is expected of him or her. An excellent example of this is the PIT crew approach to cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, for cardiac arrest situations. The term originated in motor racing, in which teams of technicians rapidly assess and repair vehicles in a matter of seconds. Similarly, PIT crew CPR consists of defining each intervention that needs to be addressed during cardiac arrest, including compressions, defibrillation, airway management, vascular access, and medications, and training providers before the call to rapidly identify, prioritize, and take over any areas that are not being addressed as soon as they arrive on scene. The effectiveness of PIT crew CPR is dependent on defining clear roles and responsibilities among team members. It is an outstanding example of how training together can allow providers with different certifications from different agencies to rapidly come together as a team to improve outcomes for critically ill patients. Diverse and competent skill sets. As discussed, EMS providers often have varying levels of certification or licensure. Think of these diverse backgrounds and skill sets not as obstacles, but as opportunities to fill roles and responsibilities within a high-performing team. Again, the best way for a team to be effective during an emergency call is to practice with one another and become familiar with each other's tools, techniques, capabilities, and preferences so that each team member is competent before the call comes in. Effective collaboration and communication. For team members to collaborate successfully, you must communicate effectively with one another. Four important elements of team communication include: a clear message. Speak calmly, confidently, and concisely so that the information delivered or the action requested is clear to your listeners. Closed-loop communication. When a team member speaks, you should repeat the message back to him or her. This technique helps confirm that you heard and understand the message and will act on it. Courtesy. All team members expect and deserve to be spoken to politely. Constructive intervention. Sometimes it is necessary for you to respectfully question or correct team members or the team leader if you believe a mistake has been or is about to be made. This technique is not only allowed and encouraged, it is essential for effective team performance. Supportive and coordinated leadership. The team leader is the team member who provides role assignments, coordination, oversight, centralized decision-making, and support for the team to accomplish their goals and achieve desired results. The team leader is often defined by policy, procedure, or statute. He or she may be the most senior provider in the group or the person with the highest level certification. A team leader who simply commands others is not leading a team. He or she is simply directing a dependent group. A key differentiation between a team leader and a group leader is that a team leader helps the individual team members to not only do their jobs by providing support, but also to work together by facilitating coordination. In this way, a team leader helps the team produce a better outcome than is possible with a simple group. Team leaders also foster communication and team dynamics using concepts such as crew resource management and team situational awareness. That is, the knowledge and understanding of one's surroundings and the ability to recognize potential threats to safety. Crew resource management. Crew resource management, or CRM, is, in short, a way for team members to work together with the team leader to develop and maintain a shared understanding of the emergency situation. CRM allows team members with different skill sets to collaborate and communicate, fulfill their roles and responsibilities, and achieve the shared goal of the best possible patient outcome. The concept of CRM says that each member is responsible for maintaining awareness of the current patient situation and sharing any critical information with the team leader. Likewise, the team leader is responsible for listening to any critical information provided by you or other team members and incorporating it into his or her decision-making. In the loud and often hectic environment in which EMS providers work, when you believe there is an immediate or potential problem that must be brought to the attention of the team leader, CRM recommends use of the PACE mnemonic. P, probe, look or ask to confirm the problem. A, alert, communicate the problem to the team leader. C, challenge, if the issue is not corrected, then clearly challenge the team's present course of action that is leading to the problem. For example, Lieutenant, I think this additional action should be taken. Do you agree? E, emergency. If the problem is clear and critical, such as an immediate safety issue, then immediately communicate the emergency to the entire team. The CRM concept does not mean you are free to ignore the chain of command within the Incident Command System, or NIMS, structure. It means you are empowered to provide the team leader and other team members with immediate feedback in the event of a potential threat to patient or crew safety. It means the team, as a whole, recognizes the importance of every individual's input and that the team is committed to creating open lines of communication. CRM empowers people to speak clearly and concisely when they detect a problem or potential problem. Transfer of patient care. While effective healthcare teams work together from first patient contact to patient discharge, clearly not all providers will be present throughout the entire continuum of care. At several points along the continuum, the patient's care will be transferred or handed off from one unit of providers on the team to another. These transfers introduce the possibility of critical patient care errors, especially when they occur several times and in different settings along the continuum of care. Effective teams minimize the number of transfers during patient care and adhere to strict and careful guidelines when such transfers are unavoidable. Just like in a relay race, a proper transfer of patient care will allow the team to keep moving forward with patient care. When incorrect information is handed off, information is miscommunicated, or care is interrupted, the team is forced to move backward, resulting in a loss of valuable time and effort. For this reason, it is important for you to trust other team members, even those who work at different levels or for different agencies. For example, if an EMR reports a patient had a syncopal episode, but the patient is now alert, then do not assume the EMR's information is incorrect. General guidelines. If possible, a single person, the team leader, should coordinate the patient's transfer of care and report the patient information. Whenever the verbal transfer of care occurs, all team members should do their best to ensure the following. 1. Uninterrupted critical care. Whenever possible, the team member giving the report and the team member taking the report should hand off life-saving care, such as performing chest compressions, to another team member, allowing them to focus on the transfer of care. 2. Minimal interference. The transfer of patient care should occur in a location with the least interference possible. 3. Respectful interaction. Each team member involved in the transfer must be respectful of members' different roles and recognize the importance of each role. 4. Common priorities. Both the team member giving the report and the team member taking the report must focus on their common priorities, that is, critical assessment findings and patient care, vital for the best possible patient outcome. 5. Common language or system. Whenever possible, a mutually agreed upon and standardized patient handoff format should be used. See Chapter 4, Communications and Documentation, for information on PCRs. BLS and ALS providers working together. In the world of pre-hospital emergency care, BLS and ALS care cannot exist without each other. For example, if a patient experiences sudden cardiac arrest, then BLS care, including high-quality CPR and defibrillation, are the core interventions around which ALS providers build their resuscitative efforts. It would be a mistake to think of BLS care as only the first steps of ALS care. As an EMT, you may begin BLS efforts early, but keep in mind that BLS efforts must continue throughout the continuum of care. To successfully stabilize and treat the patient's condition, you must carefully coordinate your efforts with the advanced tools and techniques used by ALS providers. Remember, excellent communication skills and teamwork are essential elements of emergency medicine. Each member of the EMS team must work in harmony with one goal in mind: high-quality patient care. Where BLS care ends and ALS care begins. Many patient care skills can be considered advanced. However, the tools and techniques that you can use as an EMT versus those that are reserved for ALS providers vary from system to system. What may be a paramedic-only skill in your EMS system may be common for an advanced emergency medical technician, or AEMT, or EMT to perform in another. As discussed in Chapter 3, Medical, Legal, and Ethical Issues, it is your responsibility to understand what is allowed by the scope of practice, standard of care, and local protocols where you work. If you work outside these bounds, such as performing a skill for which you are not authorized, then you risk legal liability. This liability is not reduced because you were unaware you were not supposed to do that. It is just as important to understand that, as a key part of the emergency team, there are many ways in which you can assist paramedics and other ALS providers with advanced procedures. For an EMS team to effectively perform an advanced skill, they should train and practice together. While a good EMT knows what he or she is allowed to do in assisting with an advanced procedure, a great EMT has the foundational knowledge to understand the procedure. Most important, you must understand that when using any advanced tool or technique, the focus is always on achieving a goal or solving a clinical problem rather than simply completing a procedure. Assisting with ALS skills. As an EMT, there are many different ALS skills in which you may be able to assist. The exact list of ALS procedures and how they are to be performed will vary from system to system. In general, assisting follows a four-step process: 1. Patient preparation, 2. Equipment setup, 3. Performing the procedure, and 4. Continuing care. Assisting with placement of advanced airways. Endotracheal, or ET, intubation is the insertion of a tube into the trachea to maintain and protect the airway. The ET tube can be inserted through the mouth or through the nose. In either case, the ET tube passes directly through the larynx between the vocal cords and then into the trachea. You may also be asked to assist with the placement of other advanced airway devices. Patient preparation. The first step in preparing a patient for ET intubation is oxygenation. Recall from Chapter 10, Airway Management, that oxygenation is the process of loading oxygen molecules onto hemoglobin molecules in the bloodstream. Good oxygenation often includes BVM ventilation, including the use of an oral or nasal airway, and ensuring a proper seal, ventilation rate, volume of ventilation, and time for patient exhalation. Oxygen enters the bloodstream through the process of diffusion. The more oxygen that is available in the alveoli, the longer the patient can maintain adequate gas exchange in the lungs while the intubation procedure is being performed. This critical phase of the intubation procedure is called pre-oxygenation. Maintain a high-flow nasal cannula on the patient during the pre-oxygenation phase and leave the nasal cannula in place during the intubation attempt, a period of time when BVM ventilation and chest rise and fall is not possible. This technique, called apneic oxygenation, allows for continuous oxygen delivery down the airways during all phases of the intubation procedure. Pre-oxygenation is a critical step in advanced airway management. Always follow your local protocols regarding the sequence of this procedure. Equipment setup. Equipment sets vary depending on local protocols, provider preference, and whether direct laryngoscopy or video laryngoscopy will be used. Direct laryngoscopy is visualization of the vocal cords with a laryngoscope, while video laryngoscopy is visualization of the vocal cords using a video camera and monitor. These differences emphasize why it is important for team members to train and practice together. Typically, intubation equipment sets include personal protective equipment, or PPE, including face mask and eye shield, suction unit with rigid tonsil tip, or a Yankauer, and non-rigid whistle tip, or French catheters, laryngoscope handle and blade, sized for the patient, McGill forceps, ET tube, sized for the patient, stylet or tube introducer, or gum elastic bugle, water-soluble lubricant, 10 milliliter syringe, confirmation device or devices, including waveform end-tidal CO2 monitors and or colorimetric device, commercial ET tube securing device, alternate airway management devices, such as a supraglottic airway and or cricothyrotomy kit. Performing the procedure. While the details of endotracheal intubation may vary depending on available equipment, difficulties encountered, and provider preference, you can remember the 6 typical steps by using the B-Magic mnemonic. B. Perform BVM pre-oxygenation. E. Evaluate for airway difficulties. M. Manipulate the patient. A. Attempt first-pass intubation. GI. Use a supraglottic or intermediate airway if unable to intubate. C. Confirm successful intubation and or correct any issues. BVM pre-oxygenation. As discussed previously, it is critical that you adequately pre-oxygenate the patient before the intubation procedure, especially critical patients. Do not hyperventilate the patient during the pre-oxygenation phase because this may cause gastric distension and increase the risk of aspiration. Hyperventilation may also cause hypotension. Focus on maintaining a good seal, achieving chest rise and fall, and delivering breaths at a rate appropriate for the patient's age. That is, 1 breath every 6 seconds for an adult and 1 breath every 3 to 5 seconds for an infant or child. Evaluate for airway difficulties. While you pre-oxygenate the patient, an ALS provider should evaluate the patient to identify any factors that will present difficulties during the procedure, for example, trauma or anatomic deformities to the airway. It is crucial that difficulties be identified before the procedure begins. You may assist with this process, as well as the preparation of any equipment that will be needed to address the problems. Manipulate the patient. Before the procedure can begin, position the patient so that the ALS provider can visualize the vocal cords. Use towels, blankets, and pillows to ramp, position, and otherwise manipulate the patient so that the first attempted intubation will be successful. The ideal position is achieved when the patient's ear canal is on the same horizontal plane as his or her sternal notch, known as the sniffing position. Attempt intubation. When the ALS provider is ready to begin the intubation attempt, remove the oral airway and disconnect the mask from the bag in preparation for connecting the bag to the ET tube. Always keep the mask and airway within reach in case the first attempt is unsuccessful and you need to ventilate the patient with the BVM once more. Likewise, keep suction equipment at hand in case you need to suction the patient's airway. The ALS provider will begin by inserting the laryngoscope blade into the patient's mouth and will use it to move structures in the airway, such as the tongue and epiglottis, to gain a view of the vocal cords through which the ET tube will pass. The ALS provider may ask you for assistance in manipulating the patient's larynx, which is referred to as external laryngeal manipulation, or otherwise positioning the patient for a better view. You may also be asked to hand over the ET tube, gum elastic bugle, suction catheter, or other equipment to the ALS provider. Supraglottic or intermediate airway. Should the intubation attempts fail, it may be your responsibility to prepare and hand over the supraglottic or intermediate airway device, or, in systems where it is allowed, you may place the airway devices themselves. Confirm intubation or correct issues. If the intubation procedure appears successful, then work with your team to confirm intubation success. You may attach the end-tidal waveform CO2 detector in line between the ET tube and the bag. You may also either ventilate the patient while another provider checks for positive breath sounds in the absence of gastric sounds, or you may listen while another team member ventilates. A successfully intubated patient should have bilateral breath sounds present and gastric or epigastric sounds should be absent. Either absence of breath sounds or presence of gastric sounds suggests the ET tube was improperly inserted into the esophagus. If the intubation is confirmed as successful, then you may assist in securing the ET tube. If the intubation cannot be confirmed, or if the ET tube appears to be properly placed but airway or breathing issues remain, then you may assist other team members in correcting these issues. Continuing care. Once an intubation attempt has been confirmed as successful, the job of airway management is not over for the EMS team. You must continue to observe all of the patient's monitor readings, as well as monitor for signs of potential complications, including absence of an end-tidal CO2 level. Alert team members if the end-tidal CO2 waveform suddenly disappears. This is a sign the ET tube may have shifted out of the proper position. Decreasing SpO2 level. Alert team members if the SpO2 level begins to drop, especially below 94%. This is a sign the ET tube may have shifted out of the proper position. Increasing resistance when ventilating. The person assigned the task of ventilation should monitor for increasing resistance when the bag is squeezed for ventilation. When increasing resistance is felt, it could indicate a critical airway or breathing problem that must be addressed, such as the advanced airway device has been mistakenly placed into the esophagus rather than into the trachea, referred to as esophageal intubation. When the ET tube is placed in the esophagus, ventilation results in air being pumped into the stomach, which increases the size of the patient's stomach and leads to gastric distension. Other physical signs of poor ventilation and perfusion. Physical signs include pale skin and cyanosis. Improper positioning or dislodgement of the ET tube. Each time the patient is moved, it is important to reassess the placement of the ET tube. Verify proper ET tube position by ensuring breath sounds are present, gastric sounds are absent, and end-tidal CO2 waveform is visible during ventilation. SpO2 values are stable or rising, and the ET tube is secured at the proper depth marking. Vascular access. Vascular access is a procedure that gains access to a patient's circulatory system in order to inject or remove fluids, medicines, or blood products. Vascular access is usually obtained through an intravenous catheter placed in a vein, but sometimes through a needle or catheter placed in an artery or a needle placed into bone. Patient preparation. The first step in preparing a patient for a vascular access procedure may involve positioning the patient or other EMS equipment so the ALS provider has enough room to make the attempt. Patient preparation may also involve explaining the procedure and the reason for it to the patient. You must ensure the patient is comfortable and calm so that he or she is less likely to move during the procedure. Equipment setup. IV equipment sets vary depending on local protocols as well as EMS agency and provider preference. Regardless, regular team training, practice, and familiarity with the equipment involved in vascular access procedures can make an enormous difference in team performance and patient care. In the case of vascular access, you may be asked to gather the equipment and/or assemble some parts of the vascular access system, including spiking or inserting a needle into the bag of IV solution. While vascular access may involve either IV or intraosseous or IO access, the procedure and equipment list will generally be the same. PPE, including properly sized gloves, a properly sized bag or syringe of the IV solution, selected by the ALS provider. IV tubing and drip set, selected by the ALS provider. Macro drip set, 10 to 15 drops per milliliter for general use in trauma. Micro drip set, 60 drops per milliliter for medication infusion. Skin preparation pads, typically alcohol prep pads and/or betadine solution. Adhesive tape, torn into several pieces about 1 inch or 2.5 centimeters in length to help secure the tubing to the patient's body. Gauze, 2 by 2 inches or 50 by 50 millimeters or 4 by 4 inches or 101 by 101 millimeters. Commercial IV securing system or a device to help secure the tubing instead of or together with adhesive tape, optional. IV pigtail catheter, which is a small section of IV tubing that connects to the hub of the IV catheter and can be easily connected and disconnected from the primary IV tubing, optional. If IV access, venous constricting band, sometimes referred to as a venous tourniquet. IV catheter, size selected by the ALS provider. If IO access, IO needle, size selected by the ALS provider. Mechanical IO driver or insertion device, depending on IO system. Spiking the bag. An ALS provider may ask you to spike the IV bag. To spike the bag with the administration set, follow these steps. Begin by removing the rubber pigtail found on the end of the IV bag by pulling on it. The bag is still sealed and will not leak until the piercing spike of the IV administration set punctures this port. Remove the protective cover from the sterile piercing spike. Next, slide the spike into the IV bag port until you see fluid enter the drip chamber. Invert the bag. Squeeze and release the drip chamber until about half full. Unclamp the tubing to allow fluid into the tubing to prime the line and flush the air out of the tubing. Let the fluid flow until air bubbles are removed from the line before turning the roller clamp wheel to stop the flow. Next, go back and check the drip chamber. It should be only half filled. The fluid level must be visible to calculate drip rates. If the fluid level is too low, then squeeze the IV bag until it fills. If the chamber is too full, then invert the IV bag and squeeze the chamber to empty the fluid back into the bag. Hang the bag in the appropriate location with the end of the IV tubing easily accessible. Choose the drip set indicated by the ALS provider and attach it to the fluid bag indicated by the ALS provider. Fill the drip chamber halfway by squeezing it. Flush or bleed the tubing to remove any air bubbles by opening the roller clamp. Make sure no bubbles are floating in the tubing. Saline locks or buff caps are access devices used to maintain an active IV site without running fluids through the vein. Saline locks, also called heparin caps and heparin locks, are used primarily for patients who do not need additional fluids but may need rapid medication delivery. Procedures will vary based on local protocol, available equipment, and provider preference. One way to set up a saline lock is to attach it to the end of an IV catheter and fill it with approximately 2 milliliters of normal saline to keep blood from clotting at the end of the catheter. Saline remains in the port without entering the vein. Performing the procedure. While the ALS provider is establishing IV or IO access, you may help to stabilize or, in some instances, restrain the patient's limbs or simply hold the patient's hand and provide him or her comfort. You may also be asked to assist the ALS provider by handing over equipment as requested. Continuing care. Once vascular access is established, continue patient care by observing the access site for swelling, bleeding, discoloration, or leaking. Also, observe the IV tubing to see if it is improperly blocked, clamped, kinked, or if the bag of IV solution is empty. Troubleshooting team conflicts. As outlined in this chapter, applying the principles of effective emergency healthcare teams will help to minimize interpersonal conflicts. However, because most emergency healthcare teams consist of highly trained, enthusiastic, and dedicated people, it is inevitable that conflict will arise from time to time. When conflict occurs, keep in mind the following five techniques. The patient comes first. Regardless of interpersonal conflicts that may arise, the patient's needs must always come first. Do not engage. If the problem causing the conflict does not directly and immediately impact patient care, then do not engage. Have the discussion after the call when more positive communication may be possible. Keep your cool. Maintain your composure. If you feel that the conflict is over a critical component of patient care, then follow the PACE mnemonic discussed previously. If it is not, then begin by taking a deep breath and slowly counting to 10. Separate the person from the issue. If the conflict arises from the behavior of another team member and the conflict cannot be delayed or avoided, then focus on the behavior itself rather than the individual. Choose your battles. Remember, there is strength in diversity of team members. Not everyone will work in exactly the same way, and that is a good thing. Avoid engaging in conflict over minor issues in patient care that center around one provider's style over another.